Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest edition of the Oxford Energy Podcast from OIES. My name is James Henderson. I'm Director of the Gas Programme at OIES, and we're recording this podcast on the 21st of July, 2021. The topic today is the EU Court of Justice judgment on the 15th of July, 2021. Which rejected Germany's appeal against the 2016 OPAL exemption decision and reinstated the 2009 OPAL exemption decision, under which Gazprom's OPAL bookings are restricted by 50%. In making this judgment, the CJEU has largely followed its Advocate General's opinion, which was delivered in March 2021. And this was analysed in two recent OIES Energy Insights by Dr. Katya Yefimova, who is a senior research fellow at OIES, and Professor Kim Tallis, who is director of the Tulane Centre for Energy Law. Today, we've invited both Katya and Kim to provide their assessment of the court's judgment and its broader implications. Katya, Kim, hello, and welcome to the OIS podcast series.
Hey, thanks.
Thank you.
Katya, let me start with you, and let's have some background. Can you just give us a couple of minutes on the OPAL pipeline? What is it? Where is it located? Why is it so important?
Well, OPAL is one of Nord Stream's onshore connecting pipelines, Nel being the other, which connects the Nord Stream's landing point in Greifswald in Germany with Brandov at the Czech-German border. OPAL, because it's a connecting pipeline to Nord Stream, is important as Nord Stream is one of the Russia's key direct gas export corridors towards Europe. It's operational since 2011. And it has a capacity of more than a quarter of all Russians' gas exports to Europe. Hence, obviously, an importance of OPAL as connecting pipeline.
And it's been underutilized for most of the time since it started operating. Why is that? Can you explain the regulatory framework a bit, particularly, obviously, that governs the use of the pipeline? And can you explain the latest ruling, perhaps at a high level, and how it changes the framework around OPAL?
That's right. Although in 2009, the German regulator, BNetzA, has approved the OPAL's exemption from third-party access and bundling rules and tariffs in respect of the entire OPAL's transit capacity, the European Commission has later requested an amendment, a regulatory cap, which prevented Gazprom from utilising more than 50% of OPAL's transit capacity. And that's the 2009 OPAL exemption. As no one else but Gazprom has the gas available at the entry point to OPAL at Greifswald, obviously the pipeline has operated underutilised because of that cap. And obviously the decision... The 2009 OPAL exemption decision had no regulatory rationale, it has no competition rationale. And increasingly, absurdity of this situation was becoming more and more apparent, which caused the European Commission eventually in 2016 to amend its exemption decision of 2009 to remove the cap and allowing Gazprom to bid for the remaining 50% of capacity alongside with third parties on Prisma capacity auctioning platform. And then Gazprom was able to utilize at least 8% of OPAL's transit capacity. However, in 2016, the EU General Court suspended the 2016 decision in December 2016 in response to Poland's complaint. Then the court lifted that suspension in its provisional ruling in July 2017, and auctions, which have been briefly halted, are then restarted. But then later, in September 2019, the court came with a judgment, and again, in response to Poland's complaint that energy solidarity has not been taken into account when making the 2016 exemption decision. And the court, general court, agreed with Polish complaint and ruled to annul the 2016 exemption decision. And then Germany appealed that decision, and it was on that appeal that on the 15th of July this year, the EU Court of Justice issued its judgment and rejected the German's appeal and effectively annulled the 2016 exemption and reinstated the 2009 exemption decision, restricting Gazprom's bookings again to 50% of Opal's transit capacity.
Okay, so for the simple listener then, of which I include myself, so we had a restriction in 2009 to 50%, which was changed in 2016 to increase the amount of gas that Gazprom could put through the pipe to 80% plus potentially another 20%, to which the Poles objected. And essentially, the Polish objection was then kind of upheld in 2019 using the principle of energy solidarity. The Germans have appealed against that decision, and their appeal has now been turned down, effectively meaning that the principle of solidarity has taken sway, if you like, and the Polish argument has won. Would that be a very sort of succinct summary of what's happened? You're nodding your head. Okay, great. Kim, let me come to you then. So how does this judgment compare with the other developments in the case? And, you know, it's essentially, what's the general court done and relative to the opinion of the Advocate General?
Yes. Well, most of the academic and expert commentators see the judgment as a somewhat of a disappointment. But it wasn't really a surprise, because the new judgment now follows very same logic and approach that we already saw in the judgment from the General Court and then from the opinion of the Advocate General. And if anything, this new judgment provides less guidance and less details than these two previous steps that we saw before the European Court of Justice. And I was thinking about the reason for this a while back when we saw the judgment, and it's probably connected to the unanimity decision-making requirement at the Court of Justice. This judgment was given in the grand chamber composition, which means that we had 15 judges that all had to agree on the wording of the judgment. And that necessarily means a low level of detail. These grand chamber decisions are taken in cases which are either interesting for a more general point or important, like in this case, the enactment or creation or finding of a new legal principle. And so from that perspective, it really wasn't that different, just more general in scope.
Okay, and so as I understand it, is that lack of clarity, if you like, that lack of definition, which is the problem here, particularly around the energy solidarity principle. So the judgment confirmed the existence of that principle as a general principle of EU energy law, but what does that actually mean in practice? What's the scope of the application as a result of this ruling?
It's extremely wide. The judgment talks about interests of all affected stakeholders or stakeholders that are liable to be affected and measures that might affect their interest in security of supply, its economic, political viability, and diversification of sources of supply. So it really is a very wide application. And in practice, it means that we need to now, in all decision-making that is based on EU energy law, we need to balance between the interest of those that might be affected and then those that are within the immediate application of a decision or whatnot. So that type of balancing exercise is now necessary for all kinds of decision making. But it doesn't, and I think quite importantly, it doesn't mean that solidarity requirement translates into an absolute prohibition in providing or creating negative effects. It simply means that those negative effects that might come from a decision or a new legislative instrument have to be balanced against the positive impact of that same decision or legislative instrument. So it doesn't dictate an outcome. It just means that you need to balance. And for the Opal case specifically, it doesn't mean that the 2016 decision would be wrong in its, you know, outcome. It simply means that we need to now balance the positive impact of the 2016 decision to the possible negative impacts that could come from the decision within the region where OPAL is located.
Okay, I mean, indeed. And reading your report, I think the point you made strongly was that the main complaint was that the court had not even tried to apply the principle of solidarity or had not taken it into consideration enough in its initial ruling. So it didn't mean the initial ruling was wrong, but just they hadn't taken the principle of solidarity into account. So really what the ruling is saying is that in future, you need to take that principle into account and, as you say, balance it against the positives.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Got it. Okay. Well, I'll come back on the detail of that solidarity principle in a minute. But Katja, let me come back to you and ask you about the implication of the court's ruling for EU exemption decision-making process in general and also for the OPAL exemption in particular. So what are those implications, do you think?
Right. Well, as Kim's just said, the court essentially ruled that the legality of any act of EU institutions which falls within the European Union's energy policy must be assessed in the light of principle of energy solidarity. So a quote from the judgment. And that means that the court has made an assessment of the impact of energy solidarity, pretty much an integral part of any exemption decision-making process, be it OPAL or any other exemptions that might be issued by the Commission. And in other words, that basically means that any exemption made by the Commission must include an assessment. How exactly to make that assessment and how exactly to balance the interests of different stakeholders, how to take into account the interests of different member states, how to balance positives and negatives, that has remained an open question. And that brings us back to the very general nature of the court's judgment in respect of energy solidarity. But as far as this specific OPAL exemption decision is concerned, it would essentially have to be reviewed in order to take into account the impact of the energy solidarity, because the court ruled that that impact has not been taken into account. So I would envisage that kind of a review process. But importantly, and again, as Kim has said, the court did not say that the OPAL 2016 decision was detrimental to Poland's energy security or anyone else's energy security. It just ruled that no assessment of any such possible impact has been made, and it will have to be made in the future.
Okay. So, Kim, let me come back to you then, and let's talk about this solidarity principle and how it operates. Because from your paper, it seemed to me that there was a kind of potential conflict between the solidarity for an individual member state and other member states, and then an individual member state and indeed the EU as a whole, and whose solidarity took priority seemed to be a pretty major question. So what does that mean for, you know, for countries, but also for private parties like investors and other companies?
To me, this judgment has an impact on at least two different areas. One is the activities of the legislator of the EU, and then the second one is the activities of regulatory authorities that apply that legislation. And for the legislator, it seems to me that this principle of solidarity and the judgment now needs to be considered as a part of the legislative process. And I would even argue that it would be at least prudent to show in every legislative instrument within EU energy law and policy that this type of consideration has actually been carried out. And we've seen this same type of approach in relation to the principles of proportionality and subsidiarity. We usually have in all EU legislative acts a preamble saying that these two principles have been considered as the part of the legislative process, and that's pretty much it. And I think that type of exercise needs to be done now. As for the application then of EU energy law, the principle requires now that we have a balancing exercise, and we consider that the different effects on different stakeholders, even if they don't raise this point themselves. So it needs to be ex officio, meaning that the regulator needs to consider this without a request to do so. In practice, though, it means that any investor, any private company has to integrate solidarity assessment in their application for example, a exemption or derogation, because they can't let or rely only on the assessment of public authorities, but they would have to come up with arguments in that respect on their own. The problem, of course, is, like Katja said, there's not that much detail to go on. So that's a bit of a problem from a private company perspective, that you need to rely and provide arguments around a principle that you really don't know the content and meaning yet. And considering the huge amounts of capital that is usually related to these energy investments, that's a legal certainty question.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's about leads me on really to the next question, which I'll go back to you, Katja. Did the court provide any kind of methodology then for making any this type of assessment? Because that would seem to be pretty crucial. Is there a methodology spelled out?
No, it didn't. It didn't at all. And it is a big problem. The court has obliged to conduct an assessment of energy solidarity impact, but it provided no indication whatsoever how to do that, how to balance, again, to quote the judgment, how to balance those interests where there is a conflict between different parties, let alone a methodology for assessing the impact of exemption decision. This gives the Commission essentially a very significant leeway in respect of scope and depth of any such assessment. In fact, the General Court provided even fewer details on how to conduct an assessment than even the Advocate General's opinion, which sort of elaborated a little bit more on the assessment of the impact of energy solidarity. And it essentially said that it will have to be made by the Commission, that the Commission is far better equipped and knowledgeable to make an assessment. It said that there is no, it provided no blanket blueprint on how to do it. It said that it's different in different cases. It should be made on a case basis, case-by-case approach. It shouldn't be prejudged. And there are some clearer areas on assessing energy solidarity. And there's some, I quote, grayer areas of energy solidarity assessment. But it didn't elaborate on how to measure and how to address that grayness. And the court's judgment has provided no indication whatsoever, even less than the Advocate General's opinion. And again, the point I tried to make in my paper on the AG's opinion was that it would be unacceptable, really, if the Commission were allowed to both define the criteria for the impact assessment of energy solidarity principle and then conduct the assessment with only limited possibilities for judicial review. And in my view, and that the argument I made in my paper, is actually a failure by the court to define the criteria for the assessment, in my view, sort of tantamount to admitting its failure to demonstrate that energy solidarity is a legal principle. It basically said, well, that's a principle you have to take into account, but we don't really advise on how to do that. And I think that is a problem for all the reasons that Kim has just listed previously.
Okay, thanks. Well, that certainly sounds like a concern. And Kim, let me come back to you. I mean, are there some specific legal concerns in relation to this principle of energy solidarity then?
Well, one is clearly raised by Katja, the fact that the Advocate General really suggested that it would be very, very limited judicial review. And judicial review is a fundamental right. So effective judicial review is a fundamental right. And lack of that type of suggestion is highly problematic. The court did not discuss that point because it didn't have to. And typically when the court doesn't have to, it doesn't do that. So that's an open question. What type of judicial review do we have? And that's probably going to be answered in future cases. So that's clearly one. The second very clear problem is the WTO compatibility with the end result, because the previous decision, which is now reinstated, had been found to be incompatible with WTO legal regime by the panel report in the EU energy package case, Russia versus EU. And that now, we have the situation now where that same regime that was found to be incompatible is again in place. Now, the WTO case is still going forward in the WTO system, but if they confirm that the previous capacity cap undermines the competitive opportunities of Russian gas within the EU market, we have a problem.
Okay, that's very interesting. So that brings us then, Katya, to the practical implications of this judgment. So what do you think is now going to happen then with the 2009 exemption decision and that 50% cap that Kim's just mentioned? I mean, is it going to remain in place or will it have to be changed?
Right. Well, for now, what the judgment means is that the 2009 OPAL exemption decision will remain in place. And with it, of course, a 50% cap on Gazprom's bookings on OPAL's transit capacity. And that will remain in place until and unless an amended exemption decision, which now will have to take into account the impact of energy solidarity principle, is issued. That is kind of a crucial point. But this amended decision, again, if this process of revising the exemption does take place, this amended decision could see the cap, which is in place, 50% cap, could be adjusted to a degree, and the nature of that adjustment of the cap would be subject to the European Commission's, in particular, assessment of energy solidarity, and it will be subject to the conditions that the European Commission might decide to attach to its revised exemption decision to take the impact of energy solidarity into account. Anything would be a speculation into what this amended exemption decision would look like. But what I'm trying to say that the 50% cap is not set in stone. It could potentially be revised to a degree, but at present it's difficult to tell by how much and exactly how. But if you compare the outlook for when the 2016 exemption decision was issued with the outlook and the conditions in place which are now, if the decision will be reassessed. Now, those are, in terms of market fundamentals, they are the same. The 2016 exemption decision was a welcome development compared to the 2009 decision. And 2009 decision, as I said before, didn't make sense. It doesn't really make sense now as well. But an important factor that now will come into play is Nord Stream 2 completion and anticipated start of gas flows through Nord Stream 2. And I would imagine that when the Commission reassesses the exemption decision and takes the impact of energy solidarity into account, Nord Stream 2 factor is very likely to impact in its approach to how to readjust the cap, if at all. And essentially, the bottom line is that for the Commission, the OPAL's cap is the main instrument on how the Commission could place a limit on combined utilization of Nord Streams 1 and 2.
Okay, interesting. And so, which leads on to the question perhaps about whether this OPAL judgment will have an impact on the regulatory treatment of Øygaard, which obviously connects Nord Stream 2 to the markets onshore and obviously runs parallel to OPAL as well. So is there going to be an impact on Øygaard, do you think, of this decision?
Well, I think what's important to kind of distinguish from the start that OPAL and Øygaard, although they're very similar pipelines, they are connected to very similar pipelines, they're essentially twin pipelines, they are governed by very different regulatory regimes. OPAL is governed by the exemption on which the court provided the ruling, whereas Øygaard is governed by so-called more capacity capacity allocation procedure in line with which the OIGL's capacity was allocated in 2017. That procedure, if you looked at it, and I published a paper on that years ago, it mirrors very closely that capacity allocation procedure, which is spelt in the capacity allocation mechanisms network code, the EU-CAM network code. So the regimes are very different. Regulated pipelines such as OIGL and exempted pipelines such as OPAL. So any kind of comparison would be limited. In my view, because you know the capacity in OIGL is now booked 8% long term, with 20% set aside for shorter bookings, any attempt to place a cap in such a way that 80% capacity bookings on OIGL would be compromised would be very, very problematic, and it's bound to unleash litigation, I would have thought. That's why I remain of the view that it is the OPAL's regulatory regime, effectively the exemption and the cap in that exemption, would be the main lever, if you like, and the main tool to adjust and to regulate the level of capacity utilization on Nord Stream and Nord Stream 2 combined. Because as far as OIGL is concerned, I would say neither the Commission nor the German regulator has very strong tools to address, even with energy solidarity being upheld as a principle. But one can't exclude it completely. But I would have thought if one would try to bring energy solidarity and jeopardized 8% long-term bookings on OIGL, that wouldn't just go quietly. I think that would be a litigation. And that may be not in anyone's interest, really.
Okay. So just as we come to the end then of the podcast now, a couple of final questions. So one for you, Katya. Just briefly, what do you think this judgment, what could be the impact of this on the utilization then of Nord Stream and Nord Stream 2, which you've kind of alluded to? What have a bit of a speculation about what you think utilization will be going forward.
Well, I mean, for the time being, OPAL capacity restriction would have no impact on the level of utilization of Nord Stream, because previously OIGL was flowing the gas which didn't fit, so to speak, into the OPAL because of the exemption cap constraint, and this gas will continue to flow through OIGL after the court's judgment, so that doesn't change things immediately. But of course, that would become a constraint once Nord Stream 2, both lines enter into service and start flowing gas, and then OIGL would be needed for its original purpose of transporting Nord Stream 2 gas as opposed to Nord Stream. But ultimately, if you imagine that 50% cap on OIGL is on OPAL is preserved, then I've done some back of the envelope maths, and Nord Stream and Nord Stream 2 combined utilization would be around 88%, provided that Gazprom is allowed to utilize all of OIGL, 80% long-term bookings, but also making short-term reservation. But if Gazprom is only allowed to utilize 80% of OIGL in line with long-term bookings, and the OPAL's 50% cap is preserved, that kind of brings down the combined Nord Stream and Nord Stream 2 utilization to around 78%. So it's still not bad, really.
Okay, so that's the worst-case scenario then, sort of 78% utilization if the 50% cap remains in place. Okay, thanks for that. Now, Kim, let me come to you for the last word here. What can we expect going forward? Are we going to see more cases where this principle of energy solidarity is used as a legal argument, do you think?
Oh, certainly so. I don't think anybody could argue otherwise. If you look at the extremely broad scope of the judgment and then the lack of any guidance, you can sort of assume more cases going forward. Maybe these details will be hammered out in future cases, at least one would hope so. But I mean, if you look at the where solidarity argument can be used, you can use it in all kinds of security of supply related issues, exemptions, derogations, third country ownership of infrastructure, market impact of renewable energy, division of burden in terms of new renewable energy or fight against climate change, and many, many more. And so there's really no shortage of opportunities, and I'm sure we'll have both member states and possibly also private operators starting to evoke the principle more and more now.
Okay, well, look, thanks very much. That's a great summary. And so thank you very much indeed, Kim, for your contribution, and Katja, yours. If you want more detail on this topic specifically, then there are two papers on the OIES website, which you can access free of charge. So please do go and look for those. But finally, let me just say thanks very much again to Kim and Katja for their contributions. Please do go and look for those papers and also for other research on the OIES website. But with that, thank you very much for listening. Take care, stay healthy, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programmes, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.